Recording in progress. All right, we will now call to order this evening's study session of the Champaign County Mental Health Board, Wednesday, October 16th, 2024, 5:45 p.m. at the Shields Carter Room of the Brookings Administration Building, Urbana, Illinois. Can I get a roll call, please?
Dr. Lisa Liggins Chambers. Chris Miner.
Here.
Tony Nichols.
Here.
Joe Omosagie.
Here.
Elaine Plencia.
Here.
Jen Straub.
Here.
Hi, Jen. Jane Sprindle. Jane's not here. Dr. John Paul Joachim.
Here.
And Molly McClay.
Here.
Okay.
We would now, I understanding that our board member, Jen Straub, is online. I would like to entertain a motion to permit her to join the study session virtually. Can I get a motion for that?
I so move.
Thank you very much. Can I get a second?
Seconded.
All right. Motion is on the table to allow our board member, Jen Straub, to participate remotely. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Ayes have it. Motion carries. And Ms. Straub can participate online. Next, we have the approval of the agenda on page one of our packet. I'd like to make a motion to approve the agenda as written. Can I get a second?
Second.
Any discussion on the agenda? Anything we need to change? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the agenda say aye. All those in opposed, same sign. Ayes have it. The agenda is approved. Next, we will move to agency or citizen input and public participation. As always, all are welcome to attend the board study sessions to observe and offer thoughts during this time. And so anybody who would like to speak, you may be limited to 5 minutes per person or 20 minutes total. Is anybody in the room or online who would like to speak now?
That would like to participate and add input into the topic that you are discussing this evening. This is Alex, and he is on drug court and resides in our men's house. And this is Liz, and she is actually a drug court graduate. So congratulations to her for that. And she resides in one of our advanced shelters, and they're going to give their impact statements to you.
I was not prepared to give an impact statement. So the justice program for me has been in and out. I was in and out. And I see Shannon here today, Shannon Siders, and she was my probation officer. I went to jail so many times that they kept giving me probation, and they kept giving me probation, and Shannon, she was there for me, and she would call my mom, she would worry about me, I would go to treatment, I would come out, and I didn't take it seriously, and I ended up going to prison, and when I got out, I transferred to Peoria, and I called back to Champaign County, and Shannon was still there, and I caught up with her, and about 6 months ago, I believe I had another charge, and they offered me drug court. They were done offering me probation, and when I accepted drug court, I started to take it more seriously. And when I reported to meet my drug court officer, I saw Shannon, and she is the head of probation now. And, you know, it's motivating to see growth and progress and a structure that works for people, because a lot of times I think the justice system may catch a bad rep or something, like that they're just wanting to send people away. And I am 6 months clean now. I'm about to start work. I'm about to go back to school. And just 6 months ago, I couldn't stop, you know, using drugs for a day to save my life. And, you know, I want to thank the court system, the judge, and the drug court team, and NCO at home especially. I went to treatment 6 months ago, and I got on the phone with Max White, my drug court officer, and before this I was homeless and a daily drug user, and in treatment I called Max and he said, hey, I think I got a place for you to go. And I spoke with Cedar King at CU at Home, and it changed my life. I had never completed treatment until somebody believed in me and offered me a program that is going to help me get back on my feet. And it's impacted my life a great deal thus far, and I still think I have a lot of growth in me. And I'm thankful for everyone here. That's all I got.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth. So I thought I was unfixable, and I didn't realize that anyone would help me. I didn't know how to ask for help. And Liz and Judge Rosenbaum said, you know, we're going to extend you an olive branch and give you a chance. And they did for me, you know, what I couldn't do for myself at the time. I couldn't quit the lifestyle using, and they, you know, did it the perfect way for me. They put me in jail and then in rehab, and through drug court I learned, you know, structure. Yes, at first I found it very annoying, you know, all the meetings, all the classes, but eventually I started learning something from, you know, the classes, you know, the responsible choices, you know, they taught me. I learned, you know, I thought I had a different moral compass than everyone else because of all the things that had happened to me in my childhood. I thought that made it okay, the way I was behaving. And so those classes helped me learn to take, you know, accountability, but also realize there are some people out there that could help. You know, I never thought that my probation officer would become like my buddy, you know, like my person. Like, I would want to call him even when good things were happening. Like, Max, guess what happened? Or, you know, Max, I'm struggling with this. And, you know, genuinely, like, be excited for me. And, you know, like, when he told me I was going to be graduating drug court early, I started bawling. He was like, well, you know, why are you so upset? I'm like, I'm scared. And, like, you guys have become my people. And then, so I graduated drug court. And I joined CU at Home. And they helped me learn how to become an adult. You know, the stuff that most people don't have to think about, like, day to day. It just, you guys, you know, no, I guess I call them normal people, just know, like, this is what you do in your day. You go to work, you pay your bills, you take care of this. Like, all those kind of skills, I've had to relearn how to do those. And so, you know, they have all these different people, you know. I call them my financial planner, but, you know, they have someone there that has helped me learn how to budget, because I, you know, I live just how to get through the day. They're trying to help me live for the future. Like, what are the steps that you're going to need? Because I tried to get them to let me live with them forever, but they said no. but, you know, it's like, you know, they take, you know, Cedar's my case manager, and I've never met somebody that has been able to understand and help me understand trauma so well. And, you know, they got me set up with therapy and psychiatrist, and I take a women's class with them for codependency, which has been very helpful, because I took that class with drug court, but I'm learning even more from it the second time around. And just, you know, the group of girls and, you know, something I'll never be able to forget is, you know, see you at home, give me my first home. That no one can take away from me. It's the first place that I've been safe, that nothing bad has ever happened to me there. You know, and I had a roommate for a while. I don't have one right now. And it's been, you know, a great learning lesson to learn how to be okay with myself. So, as you can tell, I'm crying, but I'm just learning, you know, this year, because this is my, I have almost 2 years clean. Just learning how to deal with becoming, figure out who I am and dealing with my emotions and feelings and stuff. So all the different things that they're having me do is helping me get to that point, the meetings, just the community, you know. On drug court, I say I had a team of people. They say it takes a village. I had that village in drug court, and now I have that village with See You at Home. And it's just an amazing feeling to have all these people around you trying to help you become a better version of yourself. And so I'm just very grateful for them. That's it.
Thank you both so much for sharing. We really, really appreciate it. Are there any others in the room or online who would like to share during this portion? And we will have opportunity for public input later on as well. So next, we will move to chairperson's comments. And I want to first say my name is Molly McClay. I'm the president of the Champaign County Mental Health Board and welcome you all to this event. But I am now turning over chairmanship of this meeting to our fellow board member, Chris Miner, and I will defer comments to him.
Okay, hello everybody. Thanks for coming. I had semi-prepared comments. I don't want to talk too much about myself, but I kind of got to switch things up. So the reason I'm chairing this meeting is because this is kind of my area of expertise. I have a bunch of degrees, but currently I'm halfway through my PhD in criminology at UIC. That's my academic background, my professional background. I've worked with a lot of anti-incarceration reentry type organizations. First Followers, Women in Need Recovery, Dream, and a bunch of them in Chicago as well. And lastly, my personal experience. Been out of prison 15 years. I've been in the Champaign Downtown Jail, the Urbana Downtown Jail, and the Satellite Jail. And there was no resources when I got out. I found all the groups I was talking about well after. And I know how hard it is to do it on your own. There were times 5 years out, I couldn't get an apartment. I thought about going back, and I don't want anyone else to be in that situation. So hopefully here we can talk about some partnerships, see what is and is not working in the community. And I'm part of your tribe too. Look me up, Chris Miner. I've got cars, I'll find you. And I will assure you, you're not asking for advice, but I heard you mention school. I don't know if you're interested in school. Academia is very forgiving. 15 years ago, I was in prison. Now I teach criminology 101 at a major university. It can be done. So just stay positive and don't worry about crying in public. I do it all the time and I'm about to do it again. So it's all good because testimonials and stories are what's going to change everything. You have to let people know that we're not the bad people. We just screwed up and we have to get another chance. And you got to, some of us don't even get the first chance, but we got to do something. So on that, the way we're going to work the logistics of this, I have a list of everyone that's here. And I'm going to take one person first because they have to leave a little bit early. And after that, we'll have you volunteer. I'll see who wants to go, what order you want to go. Lynn's going to speak a couple minutes now before we roll into that. But then we'll just go down the line, see who wants to talk. If we have questions, questions will come.
Thank you, Chris. We did spend a lot of time trying to decide how to organize this. So I love it. So, hi. I'm the director of the Mental Health Board and the Developmental Disabilities Board. I did write down my comments so that we can do that in 2 minutes or less. The Mental Health Board has, for a couple of decades, partnered with other governmental units on behalf of trying to find good supports for people who have mental health issues or substance use issues and end up at some level of involvement with the justice system, whether it's crisis, which, you know, I mean, we have many stories about people being, maybe they're not stably housed and they end up in an obvious crisis that gets them a ride to the jail, but it's not really chargeable, and it's not, they can't really stay, so they go back out and then they come back. So a lot of that, or the hospital for emergency services, which may not also be appropriate. So we've funded some programs in the crisis space for a long time. We've also funded some programs that are offered in the jail and then in reentry from jail or prison. We've also funded drug courts, four different agencies to provide services directly to drug court participants. And these are, so there's the direct funding relationship, but there's also collaboration. So our staff have been involved with planning and trying to understand the needs and best practices for all of these years as well. And, you know, we find that maybe a lot has changed as far as funding opportunities or what the best services are, what the agencies might be capable of doing. So we wanted to hear now from our justice partners their perspective on what's currently happening and what could be better. And then we're talking about this maybe the first of a few similar discussions as we try to define what would be best for the community, for Mental Health Board to spend its money on. And then I just, you know, kind of jumping in. Yesterday we had a drug court steering committee meeting and it seemed there was consensus. I think maybe Max started this conversation that what we really need are providers of services. And so we do agree on that. I think many of us have a lot to say about it, that is the key. And we maybe have funded some things for so long that we don't know if they're the right thing to fund. But one thing I also learned from Max is that what is true right now, that you, if you're sober, it's not easy to get into inpatient treatment. That was true 36 and a half years ago when I was trying to get into inpatient treatment. And somehow I've stayed sober this whole time anyway without it. But I think that's really too bad that you have to, you know, I mean, I don't know. I'm glad that we prioritize crisis or people who really are in a life or death situation, but I think that our system could be so much better. So anyway, I think that's all I have to say. The packet is organized really just to offer materials to partners and to us. It's got a story from a resident at CU at Home. It's got a list of all of the funded programs that the Mental Health Board and the DD Board is offering right now. Some of them are not specifically directed to populations involved with justice, but they could be accessed by most anybody. There's also some information from the states, the state court's behavioral health administrator on the sequential intercept mapping. So what he's showing is services that can be found in Illinois now at various points of reach into the justice system, like that are meant to get people appropriate supports if they have a mental health or substance use issue. There are some recommendations, especially for collaborating through wherever there's a mental health court or a drug court. That type of collaboration is like really being studied and talked about a lot nationally. So we have those recommendations in here. And then an update on CESA, which has impacted our crisis services. CESA is a law that was, I think it went into effect late 21, early 22, and it has not yet been implemented. And some of us are involved with the planning of implementation on that and know exactly how it's being stuck, but there's a brief overview of what's going on with that, as well as a brief overview of where we're at with Pretrial Fairness Act and that's also having a profound impact on some of the services and on the facilities, too. So that's all I need to say. Okay.
Okay. Before we get going, is everyone kind of clear on what kind of stuff you want to discuss? I don't know if we had any actually pointed questions. It's pretty open. Just what's working, what's not working? Where should we concentrate more of our funding? Just stuff like that. So, Carrie, you going to go first?
Sure.
Excellent.
I think I volunteered. I had to leave early, so that's what happened. But so I'm Carrie Vogus, and I am the I'm a captain at the sheriff's office, and I supervise the jail. So thank you for your guys' stories. It's good to see positive outcomes, and that's what we're all here for. So I've been doing it for 21 years, 10 years in my role as captain. So I've been around when this wasn't even a discussion, really. Honestly, Chris, that's probably why you had no services when you left, because it wasn't a discussion at one point. 21 years ago, people came in. We asked the basic mental health medical questions. It wasn't anything to really get down deep into any for any reason. We didn't ask reentry questions. We didn't ask them what we could do to help them before release. That has changed. So that's some things that we have done differently with the help of the mental health board, with the help of the county board as well as for funding. So we've done several things over the last 20 years, especially the last 10 years, to get information and data to see what kind of individuals are coming in. We know society has changed, and this is what I've been saying about the new facility that we're getting ready to open. We have to realize that with society changes, the people that are coming into jail are changing as well. We should have known years and years ago when mental health facilities started closing that we might see them coming into the jail at some point. Same thing we've seen with the hospitals. We sat around a board years ago to study this with Julie, and a few of us were on it to see what we could do better in our community. And we did do some things. We've tried to do some crisis intervention and a few other things, but it really never got off the ground any further than that. And I think that there's so much more we can do. I mean, as far as the jail goes, I like to remind people that when we talk about mental health in the jail, we do have services in there that are contracted through a provider, but their main focus is crisis intervention at the moment, okay? It's suicide prevention, because we don't have tons of money to be able to provide 24-hour services repeatedly. We have to remember that they're there for that moment when they first come in, trying to get them either on medication or maybe to see a psychiatrist when they're in there. So that's a good thing, because a lot of times we can get them started on medication if they're willing. But again, it's always about willing, right? And those individuals, when it comes to the mental health, most of the people that are staying with us at this point are people that have probably had multiple times out of custody. We've probably attempted them at the hospital numerous times. And at some point, the state has to say, we can't let them out again. And they're going to seek detention, and then PD will look and see if they need to have a fitness. And those are the ones that stay the longest. And they're the hardest ones to manage, because they usually don't want to take medication. They're usually the ones that are a little more combative. They don't care for themselves well. So they're the extreme case. And we know that in the jail, we are always going to have that population. They're not going to go away. But they're going to be with us for long periods of time. So we still need to figure out ways that we can work with them. It's better if we can actually get them to fitness while they're in custody with us and they don't have to go off to a hospital. But I'll tell you one thing that I know we struggle a lot with is when we do send people to the hospital, and Julia can speak on this, those individuals that we're trying to get them mental health help now, I get that they're not that immediate crisis at the moment, but they can't fend for themselves. They can't take care of themselves. And to us, if we say they need to be involuntary, we need to do something in the community. And so we tend to take them to the hospital. And I think that they're looking for somebody who is currently suicidal or homicidal. And if not, they're kicking them back out. I can tell you, we had 1 week where I sent somebody three times to the hospital, and they were released every single time. And it's sad to say that he is no longer living. Okay. So it's a very, very sad situation. And we take these things very seriously, especially my mental health clinicians that speak to these people, talk with them, and realize that my personal opinion is they can't take care of themselves. They need help now. But I also understand the hospital's positions as well. But there's got to be somewhere that we can do better. There's somewhere. As far as programming goes, we've always been limited on programming in the jail, mainly due to building restraints. now that we are going to be opening up this addition, there's going to be additional space there as well as additional classroom. And I think we need to start thinking outside the box a little bit. We've always done volunteer work. It's always been volunteers that have come in. And if we maybe need to start looking at more classes geared towards mental health. I love the codependency and classes like that because that's a lot of what our clients are dealing with. Every time I talk to them, they're like, you don't understand, this is all I know, or one, I can't go back to where I was before. Trying to get them to understand, and that's what GROW does. GROW helps with that. We have so many programs where they talk about it, but I think more programming specializing around maybe understanding their mental health or how to get those services. You know, we have reentry right now, but that's changed, Lynn, as well, because people aren't staying in jail as long, so they're only in there for that maybe 24 hours to go to court, and they're out. You guys wanted to have someone touching them, as many people as possible, and now we're not really able to do that because they're out the door so quickly. So revamping kind of how we see people, meet people. I think what they're doing a really, really good job as far as Rosecrans trying to hit as many that request it. But again, it's at a request. So we're at the mercy of someone actually wanting to reach out. We're not going straight up to them and saying, hey, from Rosecrans or from someone that has that degree or that person, that's their specialty, going up and talking to them. We're asking at the door. We're asking them with that intent to try to get them as much resources as possible before they go. But it's only upon request. I could sit and talk forever, but I think I'm going to let somebody else talk. But I think from the jail side, we are open to whatever we can do better, especially trying to get people help before they leave. But we just have to remember that what's in there now, what's covered, is basically crisis intervention. They're not going and having therapy groups. They're not doing groups with the girls or the men. We have all the programs, whether it be parenting or GROW or anger management, MRT, all the ones they love, but I think we could probably do better when it comes down to the mental health side as far as what else to bring in. And it may not be somebody that's willing to volunteer. It may be something that we have to actually cover and cost.
Okay, thank you for that. Thank you for that. So what I'm hearing is more programs. Well, more specifically mental health programs. You have programs and the fact that you have crisis intervention, but what are lesser issues are get a little harder to get addressed? Okay. With programming, we'll ask this. I believe those closest to the problem are closest solution. Are you willing to have people with substance abuse disorders and people who have been incarcerated before actually come in? I know there's going to be certain restrictions, but is that a consideration?
Yes. So we've had we have one program now where there are actually some peers in the program, but it depends on the length of time they've been out of custody. It depends on the criminal history itself. But we do have people in there right now. We actually have quite a few peers, and one's being ran by a peer. So it just depends on the situation. But I love to have that. I think it means more to them when they see somebody right in front of them that has been through it and is in a better situation.
Anybody else have any questions from the board?
It's just pretty much a comment. I mean, it seems as if it's always going to be money when it comes down to it. It's going to be money. And we'll find out where the money comes from later.
I just had a couple questions about discharging people from prison. If they do see a psychiatrist and they start a medication, do you schedule a follow-up appointment with a psychiatrist in the outpatient setting for them, and if they need transportation, like have a social worker, like if they have Medicaid, get that transportation set up, because that's obviously covered by Medicaid. So
right now we give them the prescriptions. So if they meet with one of our psychiatrists, it's actually a psychiatrist that's set up through Advanced. If they're on medications, we give them a prescription for a certain length of time. But as far as the reentry into the community of them seeing someone else, if it's Dr. Yang or if it's certain doctors that they've been seen before, we try to get them the appointment from where they were before. If it's a brand new patient, I'm not 100% sure what mental health's doing on that as far as for psychiatry. I do believe that they're being set up through Rosecrans. Everyone who's leaving, because that's my reentry piece, and they see those people prior to leaving and have them set up on whatever appointments they have. They also are doing the transportation as well.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Just last thing. So you spoke positively on Grow and Rosecrans. Thumbs up?
Yeah, we've had some, I mean, we've had, you know, you have your ups and downs with staffing. That's just not with Grow. Sorry. staffing with Rosecrans, because it's a social service where people come and go. And that's probably been our biggest concern and issue. I've been on the Reentry Council for quite some time. And that's been part of the issue, too. People come and go and you kind of start over again. I think right now we're on a good track. We're moving forward with reentry and making some changes. But yeah, I think they come, they're regular in the jail. I don't have any issues with them. I think they're providing you guys stats and data, I hope, which they see people all the time. Chris is there from CCHCC, seeing people as well. So yeah, they're doing a good job.
Anybody else from the board? All right, thank you so much. You are awesome. Anyone who wants to volunteer to go next? I feel like I'm teaching one of my classes. Who wants to go?
All right, I'll go next.
Perfect, perfect. Go ahead.
We'll go in the order of the criminal justice system, right? So first, Carrie, because people come to the jail. So I'm Julia Reitz. I'm the state's attorney. Our role is to review police reports and investigations, make decisions about criminal charging, follow through with prosecution of cases. And I've been in this role for 20 years now, and I've seen a lot of things. I've seen a lot of successes. I've seen a lot of not successes. I think what is important to start off with is that it is not illegal to have a mental health issue. It is not illegal to have a substance abuse issue. It is illegal to commit a violation of Illinois statute. Okay, so people are not in the jail or charged with an offense because they are mentally ill or because they are abusing substances. They are in the criminal justice system because they've committed a criminal offense. And that might be in part due to their mental health issues or their substance abuse issues. I say that because ideally we would be addressing people's mental health issues and substance abuse issues before. Thank you for nodding along with me, Joe. Before they commit an offense that puts them in the jail or puts me or one of my attorneys reviewing a report about them and making decisions. Okay, so that I think is the first and most important point that I want to make, is that we should be focusing ideally on intercept zero, right, Lynn? Which is the point before any of us are involved with people, ideally. Intercept zero. See, I've been doing this so long that Lynn says I know the right words. Okay, so, and I think that is the hardest, that sometimes is the hardest part. Because that requires identifying people and engaging them before they are locked up in a jail or standing in front of a judge or looking down the barrel of a prison sentence. And that is probably the hardest piece, right? Because at that point, they don't feel the urgency necessarily, or the order of committing to and involving themselves with treatment. So so that's my first piece. My second observation over 20 years is that programs that work generally start from one person who has an idea and a passion and an inspiration. And those programs are what succeed. And so we have so many examples of those. first followers started with Marlon Mitchell getting out of prison himself and coming forward to us and saying, I want to do something, and creating this amazing organization. So many different organizations and programs that we can think of really start from that person with a passion and an idea. Right, Leon? Right? That's how I know Leon, because he's a person who is passionate about an idea and made a program, worked with a program that worked. So that's where we have to find those people. So we have to find people before they are in crisis and before I'm making decisions about them, and we have to find the people who have the great ideas and the passion to do the thing, to help those people. I'm trying to work towards me not having to do anything, you know, because if we can engage people before they're in crisis with people who are passionate about helping them, then they won't come to us, ideally. So I would say that's the goal. Now, realistically, that doesn't happen. And so how do we deal with the people who do come to the jail or who do commit a violation of Illinois law and end up in front of the jail, or in my office being prosecuted in front of a judge facing, you know, a prison sentence, that sort of thing. I think one of the problems we have in the criminal justice system is that we focus on, again, the crisis point, as Carrie said. So in the jail, we're dealing with crisis. In the criminal justice system, a lot of our programming focuses on people who are at the end of the rope. So drug court in Champaign County is a last chance drug court. You know, you get drug court if you are but for going to go to prison, not at the beginning of the process, right? We have reentry programs for people after they've been in jail and are coming back. The diversion part of things, so we're past point zero, now we're in one, step one or two, the beginning part, first offenders, people who are not being held in custody, because under the Pretrial Fairness Act, you know, it's fascinating to me that you said that people did, Judge Rosenbaum and Liz did the right thing for you by having you be in jail, right? Which Liz would say, I didn't do that. She's the public defender. She tried to help you get out of jail. I probably put you in jail. Not me, but, you know, anyway. My point is, there are a lot of people who say, you know, I needed to be in custody in order to have the time to sit and focus and realize I've hit bottom and make all of those decisions, right? But the Pretrial Fairness Act has really prevented us from, I don't want to say being able to, but being able to hold people in custody for possession of drugs or lower level offenses, because it says, no, those are not detainable offenses. And so that, incentive, that time, the programs that Carrie might have at the jail are not available to a lot of people at the front end of the criminal justice process. And so there is a lack of diversion programs. There's a lack of first offender programs. And, you know, I think maybe Shannon can talk more about that also, because a lot of that probably falls on probation officers, you know, as far as first offender type community-based things, okay? Because a lot of the programming that we have, I think, really is last resort or after you're coming back type things. So things that I would urge us to be looking at is, again, that before we get to us point, and the beginning point, to keep people from ending up walking up, climbing up, running up the staircase of the criminal justice system. So those are my thoughts.
Okay, thank you for that. I don't have any questions. I just have to say that you're exactly right about the focus on prevention. If we could stop crime from happening, or at least most of it, then you're not going to have a victim, and you're not going to have somebody with a felony designation. You're not going to have either of those. And fortunately, as someone who teaches criminology, there's not that focus going on in schools really either. It's all about reentry, which is where all the money's going now. It's like we just accepted that we have this problem that we can't get out of. So, hey, let's just try to tidy it up at the end. So, yeah, I disagree with most of what of what you said. Any more questions from the board?
I do actually have one more thought that I forgot that I meant to talk about, which is the families. So many times we have families of adults who have mental health issues, and many of them severe late onset, you know, schizophrenia, that sort of thing, that come on in their 20s, and the family support is really needed because they are struggling. And again, you know, we can't necessarily just hold somebody in custody on a cash bond that their parents aren't going to post. That doesn't exist anymore, you know. And so there are a lot of terrified parents and siblings who are dealing with family members, loved ones who have very serious mental health issues. And again, we have to wait. I mean, this is the horrible part. We have to wait until they commit a horrible offense before we can hold them and get them maybe to the treatment place that they need to be. So that is a huge issue.
I mean, one of the things I'll keep going back to is, I mean, the money for diversion or prevention, I know we're now taking care of people as they come out of corrections. How can we divert that money into the schools or into the community to work on prevention and things like that? I keep running into a young man that I knew as a kindergarten student. He's unhoused right now. And when I don't see him for a week, I'm wondering, has he been picked up for some heady thing? And it's that continues, just that back and forth. How can we, and when he was in kindergarten, I had a sense, because his family system was, they were unhoused also at that time. But I was, and it's just, I don't know what to say, but I know 20-some years ago, there was a victim-offender reconciliation program that was in this county. That was the guy just before you. And I don't know where the funds came from, but I think it's something that if there is a way to get something like that happening, it's something that I'm still willing to do it. I'm not too old for that shit. Oh, stop. I'm sorry.
Well, and I appreciate that program, the Victim Offender Reconciliation Program, again, was one of those things that started because somebody was passionate about it. It was a church-based program initially that then became part of our diversion program where people would volunteer to, community members would volunteer to sit on a panel and sit with somebody who had committed a lower-level offense and try to come up with a resolution and direct them to some sort of services. And unfortunately, we had a pretty robust diversion program. And then in 2009, 2010, when the economy went horrible and the people working in that area were retiring and we had to make budget cuts and wasn't able to, you know, continue those programs. I am looking now at a couple of online type programs and seeing if there's a way that we can restart that at a lower level. But again, that requires people with commitment and passion to do that hard work, especially if you're talking about mental health and substance abuse issues as opposed to just standard retail theft kind of stuff. But your standard retail theft, you know, can turn into an onion, as you start peeling the layers back, and end up right where we're at.
Because a lot of times it's not just one issue. I mean, I think, yes, mm-hmm. many of the young people who end up in the system have layers of things. The family systems have not been worked with. Their individual is more of is a symptom that we see of something that's behind. And I know in your criminology classes you probably talk about those things, because that individual is just a representative of something that's behind him. And hopefully there will be funds for prevention as time goes on.
Yeah, and there are so many different issues. Again, you know, so many different issues with layers of, you know, where did this start and what did, and it cuts across all aspects of criminal justice. You know, I'm thinking like Molly, domestic violence, you know, where does that fit into the programming here? You know, how the mental health issues, the substance abuse issues, the dysfunction, you know, family dysfunction issues that go into that is a whole other piece that we haven't really even touched on.
While I was about to comment on it, I mean, one thing that I'm really proud that the Mental Health Board does look at in terms of prevention is funding some of the sexual assault prevention programming that RACES does, funding Courage Connection, which does prevention programming as well. I understand that there may have been times before I was on the Mental Health Board where other kinds of prevention programming may have been funded too. And I think we have these pockets of prevention that the Mental Health Board has looked at and supported over the years, but I'm hearing from this conversation so far is that there may be more and more ways that we can look at that, and that that continues to be important. I am one of those passionate people who care, you know, my passion has been gender-based violence and doing prevention for that at the college level, and I'm not currently doing that now. But I also know how challenging it can be to be that person who is pouring all of that passion in and may need extra support. And so I know that one thing we're looking at as the Mental Health Board is to have a priority around developing, building a sustainable workforce for mental health and substance use, which could potentially help sustain people in positions in the future. So that was a comment that I wanted to share, but you brought me into it, so I'm glad that I could contribute.
Yeah, I mean, I think, too, the concept of self-care and supports for our providers is huge. You know, I mean, because it's really easy to say, oh, we need people to do this work, but this is hard work. And it's not, you know, not even, I mean, I see that not just even from the provider, but from people, my own people, all the people who work for all of us, work with all of us, you know, the mental health toll. We talk about this a lot in, I'm on the Prosecutor Best Practices Committee nationally, and the concept of, you know, mental health care for people in these jobs is huge as well.
Everyone good? Okay, thank you, Ms. Reitz. Elizabeth Pollock, would you like to go next?
Sure. I'm next in the line, I suppose. So my name is Liz Pollock. I'm the Chief Public Defender here in Champaign County. I've been in this job for almost 2 years and have been a public defender at the federal level before that for 12 years and then did a little private practice. So I like to think I have a breadth of experience. And one thing that's consistent across everything I've ever done and everyone I've ever represented is that everybody has a life history that is complicated. And my clients have a variety of issues that include trauma and substance abuse and mental health concerns, but they all start with a lack of resources from the time that they were very small and have kind of been shafted throughout their lives by various factors beyond their control when they were young people. And I would love to see more prevention. My role in this system is not one of prevention. I am reactive. And I respond when people are charged with crimes. And that is up to Julia to decide, her office to decide what the crimes will be. And it's my job to represent them to the best of my ability. We have very limited resources for our clients. Our clients who are in custody, I'm on the phone with Carrie all the time, saying, I think I have a concern about a client's mental health. Can we get them in to see your social workers? Can we get them enrolled in a class? I have been routinely disappointed by the hospital response in this town because we have people who do not belong in the jail. The jail is doing the best they can, but they are not a mental health facility. And that is what they have turned into for a lot of our clients. And that's not their role. It's not what they're prepared for. It's not what they're funded for. But we're doing the best we can to help those people with very limited resources. And I have had clients who are floridly psychotic, who are banging their heads against the wall in the jail, and the hospital says, go ahead and send them back. And it's very frustrating, I think, for us and for you guys. So, you know, my role in this, I think, is more limited because of the reactive nature of the work that we do. I've been able to add mitigation specialists to my staff through a grant. I now have two social workers, which the PD's office has never had before. And so we are using our mitigation specialists to try to connect with the providers here in town. They've been tasked with making those connections, trying to, like, if any of my attorneys have a client who we feel is in need of services, we simply refer them to our mitigation specialist and say, let's go find something for them. And a lot of times we have to try 400, 500, 700 places before we can find something that's appropriate for that individual. But I mean, that's the kind of work that, I mean, I never got trained in that. Everything I know, I've learned through experience, through years of dealing with similar types of issues. But I didn't have a psychology degree. I'm not a social worker. I've learned what I've learned, but the attorney's role in the criminal justice system, especially given the number of cases that we have to deal with the legal part. We don't have the resources to deal with the emotional impact on our clients or on the services that they need. And so I'm very gratified that we have these two social workers, but we need 10 in order to help the clients that we currently serve. So in a very limited way, what I would like to see maybe the mental health board be able to support is restarting mental health court. Drug court is not a place for people with mental health issues. It is a single problem court. It is for people with substance abuse problems. And anybody who's been around our population of clients knows that they never come one without the other. There are often dual diagnoses. We have a substance abuse issue in combination with a mental health issue. And we have, as a drug court team, we have had to reject people from drug court who have legitimate mental health issues because we don't have the capacity, the staff, or the people to help them with that mental health issue. And so people who have Axis 1 diagnoses, we have to say we can't serve them because we can't ensure that they're going to stay on their medication long enough to benefit from the drug court services. And so that has become kind of a disqualifying factor in drug court, is that if there's a serious mental health issue, we cannot accommodate that client. And so I know we used to have it. I know Julia was in on it when we had it, and I know that we haven't had it in a long time. And, you know, there's a lot of discussion and debate to be had about how we're going to restart that, but that's a priority for me. And I just hired somebody through the Adult Redeploy Grant who is going to specifically be dedicated to specialty courts, including trying to explore how we can jumpstart mental health court. But I think the thing that everybody agrees on is that we can't have a successful mental health court unless we have the resources to support it. So we need a provider. We need to hopefully fund somebody who can dedicate themselves or at least part of their practice to seeing mental health court clients. We need an extra probation officer because Max is the most phenomenal human being that ever lived. You can tell him that I said that. But he's one guy, and he is consumed with the people that we have on drug court, and we're at about half capacity for drug court. We have a 70-person limit, and we're at around 35 people. So we're trying to expand that as well using this adult redeploy grant money that we've received, which is to your point that this is all, you know, at the end of the road focused and not at the prevention focus. And I think the issue would be that we need the provider, we need the mental health care team, we need counselors, and we need an extra probation officer, we need an extra prosecutor. I've got somebody to do it, but he is on the adult redeploy grant. So that means that the only people he can serve are people who otherwise would be sentenced to prison. That is the purpose of the adult redeploy grant. So we can't use Ernie as the public defender for a preventative diversionary mental health court, because that would violate the terms of the grant that currently pays his salary. So I would love to see a diversionary mental health court, because the number of clients I have that I know for a fact would not be my client if they had the appropriate treatment, it is innumerable, the number of people that go through that. And so if we had a diversionary mental health court, then we would need all the accoutrement to support it. We need a probation officer, a PD, a state's attorney, which means we need money, and we need a provider, a counselor, and a case manager. And that is kind of like the universe of people that we need to get this thing started. And we are making some progress towards the discussion, at least. I mean, we're talking about it. It's a priority. I know Judge Dyer is in favor of it, even though he can't be here tonight. I'm in favor of it. I think that if we get the right people, Julia's in favor of it. Shannon would be in favor of it. We just need the humans and the money to do it. Yes.
There's something else behind this that you touched on, and I had meant to say it but forgot to put it in my notes, and that is that in Illinois the two service systems are separated. They have been administered by two separate agencies, and this is why on the ground you have service providers who recognize a substance use disorder and a mental health issue but can't treat them both. So right now, Illinois is working to put those two agencies together, and the director of mental health called me and asked, what do you think? And I was like, please rewrite the rules so that a provider can serve people on both sides of this. And then I talked to their consultants. They have a consulting firm also asking for input, and that was my main thing. Like, we have to rewrite the rules. It's boring. It'll take staff time, but you've got to do it so that one provider can serve a project like that and provide both types of service. It's really a very outdated barrier, and it's specific here.
I agree with that, and I actually think that, because I've been looking into the various mental health courts across the state to see what kind of models we could use and what the rules are, and et cetera, and So severe mental health may be a disqualifier for drug court, but substance abuse is not a disqualifier for mental health court. So mental health courts in Illinois under statute can treat people with both issues. I know that may be a barrier for the provider. We hear about dual diagnoses rehabilitation programs, and try finding one. I mean, it's almost impossible to get anybody in. So my priority, the next big project I would like to see happen in our county is to restart mental health court, and we're going to need funding to do that.
Kenny, I don't care.
He's a presenter. Oh.
We made him a presenter. Present now. Oh, present now. Okay, got you. I just wanted to say one thing real quick before we move on. Thank you for being exact on what you wanted. What do we have to do to get this mental health court ball rolling? I got like $2 on me. No.
I think it would help if we could look into funding a provider. I think that's the number one priority, because, I mean, look, we have staffing needs, but we're going to have staffing needs for the end of time. I mean, that's always going to be a problem in public service work, because, you know, people graduate from law school and they want to work for Capital One in Chicago and make $8 million. And if you do this kind of work, you do it because you love it and because you believe in it, not because you're going to ever make a lot of money at it, as I'm sure everybody in this room knows. But I think that the piece that, you know, we can look for alternatives, we can go to the county board and ask for staff, we can look for other grant opportunities. Like, the staffing piece is not, I don't think, a mental health board problem. I think the provider piece is where we could really get help.
So now we'll work on getting the ball rolling there, because, yeah, definitely we need specialization in that, because COs, police, attorneys, you know, they don't need to be worrying about mental health. They got a job to do, so hopefully we can find providers who can actually do that, who are specialized. Okay, Chris, go ahead. Oh, is there any more questions from the board?
Actually, I had a question. I think he's presenting, right? Okay, I have a quick question, and I know it's a big question. So we had a couple people talk about how, We send people to our local ERs in crisis, and they send them right back. What is their justification of not wanting to keep these people? Is it because they don't have the rooms? I mean, because again, we don't have a, I don't even think we have a psych floor in this city, do we?
There's OSF.
OSF does still. Okay, I didn't know they still did. So I guess what's, without like divulging too much, why do they not want to keep anyone?
Well, they don't have to answer to me because I ask them why they don't. But a lot of times they'll tell me they're looking for someone who's currently actively suicidal or homicidal. And a lot of the people we send over there, they may not necessarily tell them. They also know what to say to get out, one. But a lot of times it's just because we know they can't even take care of themselves. That's not enough for them because they say that in most cases they're not a current crisis. They're looking for that current crisis. And I know, like I said, we send people a lot. I'm trying to think of how often. And Julie, I think's office has been doing some things a little bit different on involuntaries on the civil side to try to help with that so that they have to see them. But I don't know if it's beds. I don't think it's beds. They've never told me they don't have a bed available or they don't have the staff. I just think that they're looking for that current crisis.
So, okay. There's a whole body of law on the concept of involuntary commitment, which is what we're talking about. Because, again, it is not illegal to be mentally ill. And so the government cannot hold somebody against their will because they're mentally ill. And that includes, you know, the way that a hospital would hold somebody against their will would be to enforce that through the law and the government. So there's a whole criteria. Now, we can cynically say that the hospitals are making choices and question those choices, but I think that they would say that we, the jail or law enforcement or a service provider or a family member, might bring somebody to the hospital and say, this person needs inpatient treatment, they need help. And then the hospital personnel have to sit down and go through an evaluation. And if that person does not meet the legal definition for involuntary commitment, you know, the person could agree voluntarily to stay. But if they don't, the doctor has to sign off swearing that this person meets this criteria, and then we have to go in front of a judge and have that person, have the judge make a finding about whether that person meets that definition, which is, you know, are they a danger to themselves or others, basically, is the simplest way to look at it. You know, so a lot of times when someone comes into the jail, they may make statements and be, you know, obviously have a mental health issue, and so then we'll agree, okay, take them to the hospital, and then the hospital will do their thing, or time has passed and the crisis has passed and the hospital will say, this person doesn't meet that level. And depending on the offense that the person committed, then the police might come back and then take the person back from the hospital back to the jail, or they might then just be released back to the street again without medication, without supports, you know, and that cycle continues. But we have to start from it's not illegal to be mentally ill. So how do we support people who are mentally ill?
And what I would say is, you know, the ER can't start someone on like Prozac or Zoloft or antipsychotic medication and say, oh, follow up with your PCP, like your provider. That's not how that works. So they will say you need to follow up with your doctor, and those patients often don't. And so then they end up back into the ER. And so, you know, at least from a pediatric standpoint, like when parents take their kids to the ER, they will, you know, usually when they call us, they're like, okay, they're threatening themselves or they're threatening others. Like, yeah, you have to take them to the ER. And then they will, you know, do the evaluation and say, well, if they are having thoughts of wanting to hurt themselves or others, then they will admit them. OSF is for 18 and older, but usually it's Pavilion. And then if Pavilion is full, which is, it does happen, they go to Lincoln Prairie if they have space. Otherwise, they may go somewhere else. There's some places in the northern Illinois that we have had patients go to. I think it's like Streamwood or something. I can't remember. So, you know, those beds do fill up. And that's with actively people with active suicidal or homicidal ideation. So.
And I get what Juliet is saying about it's not illegal to have mental illness. I guess I was hoping that my experiences in the civilian world were different than if you guys said, hey, we have someone who needs, you know. But the idea of knowing what to say to a doctor, yeah, I've experienced that. When you touched on, you know, parents who want to help their, especially adult children, and you can't, that hit a nerve too. And I get it. But it's like, I was hoping that at least if a police officer, a lawyer, someone was saying, this person's in danger, that there was more to do. But I get it. They have rights to be mentally ill and not treat themselves, unfortunately.
That's one thing I think that we really try from the jail. Our mental health team will call over to the hospitals. We try to give them everything we can, but they also have their hand tied. I get that. But I think that's part of the concern that, like Julia had mentioned about the beginning, is that's where my concern is. There's not enough, and you guys can't fix all that in the community. You know, I wish there was more options for people to be able to walk straight in and get the help they need, or the parents or family members when they see their child's in crisis, to get them the help they need right away. Again, that's what Julia's whole point is trying to get it beforehand. I'm, of course, once you're in jail, you know, PD is at the very end. So, of course, we're coming at with ideas of what we can do at our level. But I know that if we had the ability for people to walk in and get those services much quicker, they get to see a psychiatrist within weeks, sometimes a week at the jail. So they're going to see them a lot faster in the jail than they would in the community, which could be months out. So I hate to say it, that sometimes they come to jail, like she said, to get some of those resources, but I wish that wasn't the cycle.
Well, I think we had Rosecrans present last month, saying that they have 5 providers that for psychiatric care. Promise Healthcare. So hopefully, you know, I don't know if they're on here, would be able to help with some of that need.
Chair has temporarily been deferred back to me, but it's about to be deferred back to Chris momentarily. Yeah, go for it.
I just, on the topic of mental health court, which I am supportive of the concept, but having been through an experiment, it failed. And the reason why it failed is because we did not sit down and create the process as a team, okay? And I found, and I would say that Randy Rosenbaum, who was the public defender at that time, who was working on it as well, found that people were going to jail more as a sanction or to get them to take their medication than they would have if they were not in mental health court. And that is, you know, partially where the provider piece comes in, of needing to have a very strong, organized, purposeful provider who is leading that process, as opposed to it being a judicial court. It's very different from drug court, and I think all of the experts, all the specialty court experts would say the two things are very different, you know, because the concept of something hanging over your head like incarceration as a motivator in a substance abuse treatment is something that works, but that does not work in the mental health arena to get somebody to take their medication. And so I found, as the state's attorney, that people were going to jail more often than they would have in mental health court, you know, than if they had just been on regular probation. And I said, no, we're not doing this.
And in mental health, I mean, you have to, I mean, it's not just that individual. And I think a lot of times we are still a society that sees the individual as opposed to seeing the community behind the individual. How do you keep, how you keep that person out of a system is also about how you keep that family or his community or her community intact. And it's not that person, individual in front of you has a bunch of people behind him. And if he's if he or she, I'm just going to say he, is unhoused, that's also part of a problem. And it's part of a way we have to look at not just that individual, but that saying what in our system is broken. Because mental health is what we see, but there's a lot more behind it. And I go back to the young man that I see every day, almost every day downtown, and he's been unhoused for a while now. And he tells me about it all the time. But go ahead, Tony.
I do think as a mental health board, we need to explore a diversion program for having a mental health court. And so I've been thinking about this, and what would be some of the outcomes that we would be looking for? Would the outcomes be like, we want you to have, you know, 1 year of outpatient counseling, and if you are able to attend the 1 year of outpatient counseling, then you will avoid, you know, your sentencing. And so what are the outcomes that we'd be looking for with a diversion mental health court?
So there's you know, the pre-diversion of the mental health court, so no conviction is entered, which means that the charge is there, it's present, we know you've been charged with it, but if you complete X number of requirements specifically, then the charge will be retroactively dismissed. So you don't end up with a criminal conviction. On the team, and it would be for, it would depend on, you know, the nature of the offense, how long it would be. Like right now, direct court has 30 months and 48 months. It depends on what the charge is, because certain charges have certain lengths of probation that can be affiliated with them. So like some, you can only have 12 months, some is 24 months, some is 36 months, some, you know, and you can go up and up depending on how serious the offense was. There would have to be some requirements because a lot of these courts, we can't accommodate violence. So it would have to be nonviolent, I think, would be qualifying to do that. And it would really depend on where the money came from, I think. Because if the money comes from the grants that exist, that grant money can only be spent to defer prison. And by the time that a person is facing that length of a prison sentence, they likely already have a prior conviction. So stopping a conviction from being entered doesn't really help that person in terms of, you know, they already have a felony conviction, so it doesn't change their circumstances in that way. And so if the money comes from, like, adult redeploy, it's going to look a lot different than if we can get something that's diversionary entirely. And I think, you know, 24 months in the program is generally acceptable. You can always terminate it early if somebody is doing a really, really good job and they think that we're assured that this is not going to be an issue anymore. But we need a multidisciplinary team. Like on the drug court team, we have Rosecrantz, who handles some mental health counseling and also the groups, substance abuse groups. We've got See You at Home on the team. We've got Task Probation on the team. We've got Family Service Center for other counseling and assessment. I mean, we have like, it's everybody. We're all together and we're dealing with that issue of unhoused while also going through substance abuse, while also having criminal involvement. And so that's, I would like to see something with that level of cooperation between everybody.
And see, this is where we're going to fight.
Approved.
I just want to blow your mind and make all your dreams come true. We are currently funding a provider to offer mental health court services, and we did last year as well, but there wasn't a mental health court to serve, but they're ready to do it. So we've got a tiny foot in the door. They know that this is the direction that Champaign County wants to go, so they continue to apply for funding to support it. But it just hasn't happened yet. So that's part of our...
I don't know who that provider is. Well, they're apparently keeping themselves very quiet.
It's Rosecrantz, and they have, in the application, they indicate this is understood. So,
well, it's sort of like a chicken and the egg question then, because we're sitting here going, well, who's going to provide the services? And maybe that was kind of why I threw that conversation out yesterday at that meeting and looked at right at him and said, who's the provider? And didn't really, frankly, get a very firm response, to be very frank. I'm 20 years in. I don't care anymore, you know. So, again, based on my experience, in my opinion, what would a mental health court be? It would be a diversionary program. It would mean that somebody would leave without a criminal conviction. Part of the problem when we tried this before was that's what we started out with, and then the judge decided that everybody was going to have to plead and be sentenced to it. That's what happened. All of a sudden it was, well, I can't dismiss a case after you've already sentenced somebody to probation. I disagree about long periods of time because, again, we're talking about people with mental health issues. You know, I want to get people on the right track, and 6 months, 8 months, 9 months, let them go and call it a success, not 2 years in, because
I'm not objecting to shorter terms.
See, we're working this out.
Sustained.
You know, but it's also different because you can't have somebody come back every week, because, you know, it's not like this, right? You need more time to figure out how we're climbing the mountain. So there's a lot of things that need to be discussed. You know, it's not going to solve all the problems, but if we're going to do it, we need to do it right, and we all need to know what we're doing and what we're trying to accomplish and who's doing what. Because it's not just everybody just says, oh, well, we need a mental health court, and then we all like go, oh yeah, that'd be great, and then nothing happens because we think that's going to solve all the problems.
Online comment. Did you want to comment now, Jen? Was it something before we move on?
I have.
Okay.
I just wanted to say. Okay. I also just want to point out about this exact conversation, we also have to be certified before we can go. I mean, it's a little bit different than drug court. We have to get certified with the Administrative Office of Illinois Courts before we can start a mental health court. Drug court, you can start doing it and then get certified. For a mental health court, you have to be certified first. So that's a whole process that we would have to go through. We'd have to have everything done ahead of time. Like Julia said, that's not just a we want to do it, let's jump in, we can get it going next month. I mean, we'd have to have all the documentation ready, we'd have to know what the phases are, we'd have to know all the requirements, and that would have to be approved by the Administrative Office of Illinois Courts before we could even start taking people in. So just a little additional background info.
And Chris, you've been trying to get in forever. Did you just have a comment or?
Thank you. I'm Chris Storr. I used to work in the jail with the GROW program, and I currently serve on the Champaign County Board. And to pick up Dr. Omosogi's remark, very, very good, and I'm awfully glad to see everybody here, especially I know, but this matter of incarceration, and especially mental health, behavioral health, and domestic violence, which hasn't been mentioned yet, has been under discussion, if quietly, between county board members for years. And how can we do this? How can we help? And you rightly point out that one of the big impediments is financial resources to hire the people to develop the programs and do everything that needs to make it work. On the ballot, coming up in only a few weeks, is a measure requesting 25 cents, which I neglected to bring my prop, $0.25 per $100, 1/4 of 1 cent. That is the least amount of money that anyone can ask for a tax. And although the money is not currently under discussion specifically for mental health, the money is intended, would be intended, we hope, if we get it, for additional attorneys for the defender's office, for the state's attorney's office, for a coroner, and some other uses, including software, which is not a sexy sort of thing that we like to talk about to operate the courthouse. But this would be a financial vehicle that could be used, and bringing specific needs, especially if it's a unified program as has been under discussion here. I think Ms. Reitz made an excellent point in talking in saying, previous effort failed because it wasn't an integrated program. Well, if you don't if everybody's not singing out of the same hymn book, it's just not gonna work. So I encourage anybody who's listening and the folks around the table here to spread the word that this small sum, so many entities are asking for tax increase right now, would go for this important effort that will help our families and communities. And I think that this is a good place to stop.
Excellent. So just to check in real quick, do we have any online comments? Okay.
There was a comment from Jen Straub a while ago, but I think, do you want me to read it?
Yeah.
Okay. It says, unless Jen would like to read it herself. And for so many folks, timing is everything. If they can't get the resources on the day they've decided to seek treatment, that opportunity may not present itself again for a long time.
Okay, so anybody want to go next? Shannon? Go, Shannon.
Hi, I'm Shannon Siders. I am the director of Champaign County Probation and Court Services. I started my career out at the Juvenile Detention Center in 2002. I worked out there for 14 and a half years, and then I transferred over to adult probation in 2017, and then I just got promoted to the director in 2023. So this is a fairly new role for me, but I've been a county employee for many years, and it affected me listening to what Alex and Elizabeth had to say, obviously, because they're talking about my staff and about me. I talked to Alex briefly before he left, and he didn't mind me sharing a little bit of additional information about my experience with Alex. And there were many times where I wasn't sure if Alex was going to make it. I mean, I was constantly worried about Alex when he was on my caseload. I wasn't sure if Alex was going to be alive the next day. And I would talk to Alex's mom about, have you heard from him? Do you know how he's doing? So he has made amazing strides, but we did face, many issues in trying to get him into treatment. And just like Jen just said, there were times where he was ready and we couldn't get him anywhere. And then we miss that opportunity, and then he gets in the jail, and he sits in the jail for 30 days, and then no one will take him because he's been clean for too long, just like what Max was talking about yesterday. I mean, that happens a lot. And
somebody from Gateway. We were trying to get him into Gateway, and he had been clean for too long. We couldn't get him into Gateway. But somebody from Gateway actually helped me find a place for him to go in Peoria, which is where he ended up going at some point in time. But there are so many challenges these people are facing in trying, you know, they decide, okay, I want to do this. But, oh, we can't get you there for a couple of days, or we've got to try to figure out how to, you know, get you a transportation or get you the bed, and the bed might not be available for a couple of days, or it might not be for a couple of weeks. And then they're constantly, they're the ones that have to keep calling and trying to find out, is there a bed? And something else comes up and they forget to do that. And then we're kind of right back in the same situation again. So, I have a lot of little notes here. So family support is one thing that, you know, we talked about. Alex's mom was beside herself, worried about her son, not wanting to enable him, but also not knowing what to do. And as a parent, I can't imagine that feeling. You know, Alex told me tonight that he just turned 30 last week. When this was 3-4 years ago, we didn't even know if Alex was going to be alive the next day. And as a parent, I can't imagine what she was going through. And we have so many parents who call my staff at this point worried about their adult child, and they have a mental illness and they won't get help. They're going through a substance use disorder and they're not sure if their kid is going to be alive. So I think parent and family support is a good place to try to focus on, because those people are beside themselves. They are constantly worrying, and that is so hard as a parent, I'm sure. So I think family supports would be a good place. I also like the prevention idea. And just a little, you know, side note, I had met with some people from Reimagine Justice to try to do some restorative justice programming at the Juvenile Detention Center, which also falls under my supervision. So we were trying to do some restorative justice programming out there, and we met with a couple people about that last week. And then I got a quote from them today, and it's going to be $15,000 to get our staff trained. So, you know, trying to figure out where I'm going to get $15,000 to try to pay to get some staff trained is, you know, I was a little bit thrown off. I wasn't expecting a $15,000 proposal coming my direction when we talked about this restorative justice programming. But I think there's some prevention there that is possible by trying to do some of those pieces early and ahead of time that might help the cause a little bit. And then at probation, we have a lot of good partnerships. We do have a lot of positive things happening. Rosecrans comes in and they're doing MRT groups. They're doing anger management groups at the probation office. We also have the groups through drug court, the Family Services Center that's doing the seeking safety and healthy boundaries. We work with Cognition Works. That's a group, the responsible choices that I think Elizabeth had mentioned. So we are open, and we do, we also have sex offender treatment groups happening at the probation office. We're very open to having different services going on. We try to get our staff to be aware of what services are in the community. We have providers come in monthly. We've had races, we've had See You at Home, Grow is going to come in the future. So every month we have a different provider come in and speak to our staff about what services are available in the community, so our staff know what they can refer our clients to. But it all comes down to the people. You know, the people that are working in my department care about the clients that we're serving. And you can tell that from the way that they spoke about my staff tonight. I mean, they both talk very highly about Max and what Max has done for them. And I was at a training last week in Kane County about juveniles in detention, and they brought back a gentleman who'd been incarcerated at the Kane County Juvenile Detention Center when he was, you know, 15 or 16, and now he's grown with two kids in college. And then they brought a kid from who's being incarcerated at the IDOJJ facility in St. Charles. They brought him over, and they were asking them what experience you got out of your time in custody and what programs you liked and what kinds of things helped you. And both of them talked about the people. It's the people that are working with them that's making the most difference. And I have a lot of really amazing people in my department who really care about our clients and want to help them improve their lives. And I think that's a really important piece, that it's those relationships that are going to help us make these positive things happen moving forward.
Excellent. Thank you. And Alex caught me and got my information, so hopefully I can do some work with him, because he said he wanted to go to college, and that's a big counterbalance to having that felony conviction. People are a little bit more likely to give you a second chance when they see you've done something like that. Any questions? Well, we're getting tired. Great. Okay. All right. So now we have Megan. Oh, cool.
All right. So I am the crisis coordinator at the University of Illinois Police Department. So we have a co-response team within our department that partners clinical level social workers that respond with police officers to dispatch calls for service that have some component of mental health issues with them. So I guess I'll start with some of the things the things that are working. We're pulling a lot of research from the first couple of years that we've been sort of doing what we're doing. I think we're on our fourth year now with our team, but we're working with a research group within the university to kind of see, like, are we meeting the goals that we wanted to be meeting with this program? And one of the things that we are finding is that when we have our reach teams, our co-response teams, go to these calls, there are less arrests and there's less transportation to the hospital. And what we're also finding is when we do transport to the hospital, those folks are getting admitted. And so what that tells me is that we're doing a better job of figuring out sort of what needs to happen with those folks in those times by using a clinician, which, I mean, I think everybody can say that makes sense. It's just a matter of implementing programs like that. So that's something that's working. Another thing that we're finding that really works and probably is contributing to this is that our social workers are speaking the same language as the hospital staff a lot of times, right? So we can go there and we can use, we are doing the same assessment tools, right? And we're providing that information in ways that they can understand it rather than, or we can speak to a family member who tells us all the things that we're seeing, and then we can organize it in such a way that it's easy to understand for a provider, right? And so I think that just sort of like communication assistance there has been really helpful. So that's been really good. And I think training on the petitions that we mentioned, right, that's always a concern and issue. And before we had social workers, our officers would transport a lot to the hospital. It's oftentimes the only thing they know how to do in those moments is to get them to a provider. But we have found that some petition training, even within our university settings, right, the health setting, the counseling center, if we train them on the ways that to write a petition, again, speaking the same language, sometimes that is enough to kind of like fill in the gap there between what we're seeing, all the things that we're seeing, and saying that person needs to be admitted to the hospital to then the next person, because that's not going to come from the patient. Right, we already know that. We kind of spoke about that. So that stuff has been working, and I'm excited to get some more data and research back from our research team, hopefully soon. But some of the things that we're noticing that are sort of obstacles or opportunities for us is a lot of siloed communication between agencies and providers. And so oftentimes, even between providers who are able to talk to one another, right, we just don't talk to one another. And so we were sitting in a meeting just like this, and we learned that, you know, the jail doesn't get the full report that the officer just wrote, even though it has really good information from it, right? And so how do we bridge that gap? And oftentimes probation doesn't get that information, right? When they're dealing with folks and trying to help them, they never even knew that there was a mental health issue from the first encounter with law enforcement. And so, again, how do we figure out how to deal with that? Those seem like the low-hanging fruit that maybe we can kind of work on, but we need to do it probably systematically. Another thing that we're seeing is just the severity of, and I'm sure everybody in this room is seeing that, the severity of the illness of folks is pretty extreme. And so we're having contact with a lot of folks with serious mental illness, but on the very extreme ends of that. It's gotten to be very, very difficult to help those individuals. And sometimes arrest does have to happen, right, because they've committed a crime that is arrestable, and sometimes it's the only avenue to connect them with a mental health provider. But then the obstacle that we're having, because they have that in the jail, the obstacle we're having is they're getting released before that happens, right? And so that's one of the things that we're like, oh gosh, I wish that we could have got them seen while they were there, because now they're back unsupported on the street, kind of as others have mentioned. So that's been a struggle for us. A lot of those folks with that serious mental illness that commit those low-level crimes that cause a lot of police contact, but they don't really belong in a jail. They also don't really, as we talked about, meet criteria for inpatient hospitalization. And so you have these sort of folks in the middle who are very ill and lack the ability to see that they're ill because of their illness, but they don't fit in either one of these systems, and so they're just kind of floundering a bit, and unfortunately, we see them decline over weeks, and it's only until they decline so badly that they have lost significant weight or, you know, can't feed themselves that we can actually do something. So that's been a struggle for us as well. I think somebody spoke to this, but turnover for some of the big agency providers has impacted the programs that they can provide. So we made a lot of referrals to Rosecrans's ACT program for a while that worked with seriously mentally ill folks with justice involvement, and they for several months couldn't take any new referrals or couldn't service the people that we referred because they didn't have anybody on that team anymore, because they, you know, they lost all of those folks. And so somebody mentioned supporting the staff that are already in these positions. I think that's an incredible idea to be able to kind of keep some sustainability in those programs. But I think that's all the notes that I made so far. So those are my thoughts.
Cool. I'm sorry to interrupt, everybody. I'm supposed to be on a volleyball court in West Champaign in 20 minutes. So I had it calendared until 7:30. I'm going to have to leave you all, and I'm sorry I didn't get to hear from the people that I haven't gotten to hear from yet. But thank you for doing this and having us.
Thank you for being here.
And if anybody wants to chat, I am available for that. Anybody's got ideas, you want to talk, figure it out from the PD side, let me know. And thank you.
Thank you. One question. So you're talking about doing the social workers riding along with cops. The social workers aren't in police uniforms, though, are they?
I'm wearing something that they would normally wear, right? It has our logo on it. However, they go to all calls that the police go to, not just these mental health calls, right? So they are riding on patrol with them all day long. So because that's what gets them there very quickly, right? So they do wear ballistics vests, right? Because they are dispatched to all 911 calls. Fair. It really hasn't been an issue. Like if somebody will say, like, why are you wearing that? We simply tell them why we're wearing it. Oh, I ride around with the police all day. And they're always like, oh, okay, that makes sense, right? But, I mean, they usually wear something like what I'm wearing today.
Gotcha, that's okay. I just asked because I have a master's in social work, so we've talked a lot about this, if you're just a police by another name. But that's all good. Any questions from the board?
So you're with UIUC. So are most of the contacts you're talking about actually U of I students, or are they just community members who happen to maybe be unhoused, or is it a variety?
Yeah, it is definitely a variety. I will say, of course, a majority of our clients are students, right? That's the students, faculty, staff. But we also have a pretty significant portion. I would say about a quarter of our calls are really more community members, generally folks from the homeless community that kind of wander around campus, basically, and kind of hang out there. So we do have a pretty significant amount of folks that kind of fall into that category.
So do you feel like you're seeing an increase, like you said, these bigger mental illnesses in the current student body?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Across the board.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And as teaching at college and university, there's a lot of unaddressed stuff. I think it's a lot of overlap from COVID, from the seclusion. A lot of people can't adjust back. I'm having issues myself sometimes. So, yeah. Did you have, you got more, Chris? Oh, okay. I didn't know. So is anyone here not spoken? Does anyone here want to speak? I think Lynn has something to say.
Actually, I have one more question for Megan. I'm sorry. So where does majority of your funding come from? Does it come from the university or is it get county dollars also?
That's a good question. I don't know the exact answer, but our funding for our police department is, I believe, solely through the chancellor's office, right, through the university. Our team has applied for and received a SAMHSA grant that we use partially. It's for a training grant, but our crisis responders train as part of that, and so we get some money for computers and things like that to pay for that. But as a general sort of rule, it comes from the university's funding. I mean, I was the first person hired on our team, and it was diverted directly from an officer, what it would be an officer salary.
Okay, so I guess to summarize what we've heard tonight, mental health courts, but not the way it was done last time. Have some better collaborations, try to try something else. Money, lots and lots of money. We need money. Where are we going to find money? We need $15,000 for her. We got that hanging around? No? Yeah? Oh, I guess that was easy. There you go.
Can I just jump in on that? Because
absolutely.
I was just telling Shannon and Chris, I'm going to throw this sort of at you as a county board member. ARPA funds. Have them.
So funny you should mention because that's...
Is that what you wrote on your piece of paper?
Yeah. Oh.
I mean, I think there are still ARPA dollars at the county. Well, that's because we keep giving them away. Anyway.
We put them for good use. Yes, ma'am.
Not internally. And I'm going to stop talking now.
What's ARPA fund?
It's the American Rescue Plan Act. It was...
Leftover money that didn't...
Well, let's get that spent.
The deadline date for ARPA funds, I think it's next year.
It's the end of this year.
Oh, okay. So, Reimagine Justice, we will be there. Okay.
Okay, so with that, is there anything else we need to cover tonight?
Oh, yeah. I had a question that might turn into other questions. Sorry, everyone. Megan, I was wondering who, if you don't mind sharing, because I think you said you have a SAMHSA grant, but also there's a research team that's evaluating the programming. Is that a research team at the University of Illinois? And if so, like who is this research team, and are there more of these research teams out there?
So our research team is several researchers through the School of Social Work's research lab. So there is a professor, Dr. Rachel Garth. She heads it, along with another researcher through UIS in public health in Springfield, Dr. Brian Chen. So they really sort of like are kind of organizing it, and then they have students as well who help us out. But the university is ripe with researchers, so.
I might have another question, but I also feel the pressure of we might be leaving. I know Dr. Garth well, so I'm not surprised that you mentioned her. But one thing that we've talked about on the mental health board is, you know, having more collaborations with the university in terms of being able to evaluate outcomes, being able to bring in grant money to support some of these programs. So that's something I wanted to mention. I guess one theme that I know board members have asked about and many folks who have shared tonight have talked about is this issue of individuals who need some kind of support that do not rise to the level of being hospitalized. And as a therapist in the community, it's not very common that I send somebody to the hospital because of One, knowing that they might get turned away. Two, it's a really big, it's a big thing to be hospitalized for this, and to, because it does restrict a person's freedom. And I've recognized, you know, with people I've worked with, there are times when an intermediate level of support is needed beyond, I can't, you know, like, seeing you once a week, Molly, isn't enough, but I know that I'm not going to be able to be admitted to the hospital because of, I don't have an active plan to harm myself or someone else. And I've had difficulty for people who are resourced in such a way that they can see me for therapy, even getting them into an intermediate program like intensive outpatient treatment, which might be online, it's not, you know, in a facility necessarily, can be extraordinarily challenging. And yet I know that some of these intermediate programs can have really strong outcomes for people. And I know that sometimes it's about having a place to go where there are caring people to look out for you and support you, and you could be able to talk to them. And so I guess I asked to everybody, partners who have joined us tonight, board members and anybody else, if we could create an ideal place for people who really need support, but the hospital and the jail are not appropriate, what would that place look like, and who would the providers, what providers and peer supports would be there to support them? Like, I'm thinking of like a dream big kind of question. So what do y'all think?
I'd kind of like to know what happens in my setting. Can I talk? Oh. I'd like to know
what happened. It's coming back. They lost funding for 1 year. That was state funded. It went away for 1 year and it's back.
Okay.
They may be having trouble staffing it. I'm not sure, but it's back.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. And then anytime you don't have a place to send somebody, we have 9 groups. We have 3 that meet in the community. There is no reason why there isn't any human being that cannot come into our groups. And what we don't get is people walking into our groups that have been referred. And at one time, we were like everybody's right hand. Oh, if we can't get you in, or if you're on a wait list, go to Grow until we can get there. That's not happening right now. Of course, the groups that we go to where we have the captive audiences, where we walk in and they're there, yeah. But as for our community groups, I can't tell you the last time someone walked into one of our community groups and said, oh, I was referred by Molly, or I was referred by this person. It's not happening. And so we've been trying to do an all-out blitz in the community, making sure Rosecrans knows about us, Promise knows about us, First Followers knows about everybody that knows that knows about us. And because I think of the staff turnover, I mean, we've been here since 1978. Everyone should know Grow exists. We're here. And so I think that's a lot of it, and it's the silo thing people aren't talking about. I guarantee if you come to a Grow group, we know your resources because we've used them. And so even if it's a resource thing where people have broken down, that's how we started, with serving the most chronically mentally ill. I was one of them. And so I think that we just need to make sure that we know what's going on in our community and who's serving. And so that's all I have to say.
I think that's very accurate. Someone made reference to Promise Healthcare actually has a no waiting list for psychiatry. And we're like, what? And I used to be in media, and I'm like, they need to get some PSAs in this town. You know, Dr. John said, as a pediatrician, he didn't know that. So I totally understand what you're saying about these silos, and I don't know how we fix that among providers, but it's got to be fixed quickly, because there are a lot of fantastic resources out there that, you're right, people don't know about.
Well, that, and there's no wait list in Grow. I promise you, if we end up with too many people in a Grow group, we'll just start a new one. And we are, and I hope people realize, and I know I'm probably preaching to the choir, We are a whole lot more than just a weekly grow group support meeting. We are a comprehensive rehabilitation leadership model. And I think that gets lost sometimes, especially people who know us know that. But this community doesn't know us anymore because of all the new people that's come on board. And, you know what we went through COVID. So, yeah, longevity is important. Having the same person, I was listening to you guys. It's been there 20 years, been there. People like to see the same people. They don't want to walk in cold, mentally ill, and tell their story again. It's not fair to them. And so, you know, I guarantee you if you come to Grow, you won't walk in cold because everybody's going to know your story. So just keep that in mind.
As we're ending a last historical note, I was just sitting here thinking how far we as a society have actually come on this. If you have never toured one of the big mental institutions that are now museums, there's one in Traverse City that is the size, was when it was operated, the size of a small liberal arts college. There's one in Athens, Ohio, where people used to be sent. And I've been trying to find out what happened to a great uncle of mine who went into one of those. The family, probably out of embarrassment, kept listing him on the census as home. And all of the graves in the substantial cemetery of this former mental institution have no names on the tombstones. They only have numbers. So if you could ever go to one of those and just tour it, and the size of the rooms, the cells, the massive iron gates that close off different corridors as if needed quickly. They're different, you know, but I've been to two or three of them, and we are sitting here talking about these things and solving it in a community is really pretty amazing where we've come from. So thank you all for being here.
That's all. Go home.
Recording stopped.